morning I shall be talking about freedom. There are some various reasons why I want to talk about freedom. But one of them, let's just say, I've been in various debates over the past few years with people from varying spectrums, usually from the political left. And when I introduce the question of freedom and try to think through the concept of freedom, there are a variety of responses to this, and there are two particularly extreme responses that I just think are incredibly political and counterproductive. At least two, these two responses are, on the one hand, that the very attempt to try and provide a universal concept of freedom is itself somehow complicit with oppression. This is a kind of overgeneralization from a certain genuine historical tendency, wherein certain kinds of conceptions of what it was to be a free, rational agent, which were largely implicit, within mechanisms of oppression, were used to distinguish the civilized from the uncivilized, or whatever, and form various kind of ideological roles within, you know, the axis of colonialism or patriarchy or any particular structural oppression you want to talk about. Now, my principal objection to this is similar to an objection, it's the same objection to the issue of intelligence I raised yesterday, which is, look, either you try and make it explicit or you leave it implicit. And if you leave it implicit, you're guaranteed for it to have oppressive consequences, right? Because people will simply project their implicit biases of what constitutes being a free agent, right? And you can try to get around that, and that leads to the other objection, which I'll talk about in a bit. But basically, my answer is, we have no choice but to attempt to be explicit, to try and work out what it is to be a free agent. And we have to do it in a way which is universal enough to extend beyond the human. I don't mean to simply the animal realm. I think there are elements of the animal realm that this forces us to reconsider. Great apes, dolphins, at least. But importantly, you know, into the more kind of like sci-fi scenarios of aliens and artificial intelligences. The latter being the more imminent, because we are about to, we're at the beginning of the age of artificial intelligence, and we're at the point where ethical questions regarding our relations to the machines we create to do things for us are going to become pressing. So that's the sort of motivation for thinking about freedom on the one hand, but the other way of trying to get around the whole implicit bias thing is by completely universalizing the conception of freedom in a different way, which is to say, thinking that everything is an agent. We'll just say everything is an agent. You just got to respect everything, from, you know, from mammals to plants to bits of lint to galaxies to fictional characters, and it goes on and on and on. And this is the sort of thing that you get in actor network theory and its political appropriations and what's called neo-materialism and also object-oriented philosophy. There's this attempt to get around the problem of agency by saying everything's an agent. And that's fundamentally just to evacuate the problem of agency of any actual content. It's not a solution, it's just a refusal to acknowledge it's a problem. You project implicit conceptions of agency into the things, and whenever there's anything particular in your implicit conception is pointed out, you go, well, okay, that's irrelevant because of other things. There are other issues that we have at the moment. Things. And I just think that's you know, we have to both have an explicit conception of freedom, and it has to be particular. It has to distinguish between agents and non-agents. And there's going to be three sort of guiding distinctions I will use in the talk. Distinction between positive and negative freedom. It's a very kind of traditional distinction, most famously formulated by Isaiah Berlin. Sort of roughly the difference between freedom from and freedom to. Having one's freedom constrained by others and the actual capacity of that. Qualitative and quantitative. And this is where this fundamental distinction between agents and non-agents comes in. That's the fundamental qualitative distinction regarding freedom. What can we even talk about as having more or less freedom? And what can we just, is that form of talk just irrelevant to it? And there are other qualitative distinctions that can be made, more nuanced ones, but there are also qualitative distinctions about being more or less free, having more or fewer capacities, and having more or less constraint upon this. The third distinction is the distinction between rational and actional. And this is a distinction between kinds of capacities. So fundamentally, actional capacities are just capacities to do things. Right? Our capacities to live, love, and enjoy life to the full, as well as work, and anything you can think of doing. Rational capacities are those specific capacities that are necessary to have these. Right? There's a certain sense in which you need additional capacities in order to be able to deploy your actual ones. So, just basically, very intuitively, decision making. Right? This is what you do, this is how you decide to do it. Those are my three guiding distinctions. The fact that these are on the same side as each other is irrelevant. These cut across each other. You can talk about qualitative negative rational capacities, you can talk about quantitative rational positive capacities, it doesn't matter. There's that question about that fundamental qualitative question about the difference between agents and non-agents. What I'm going to do now is go back to the history of the concept of freedom, or a particular part of the history which I think is an important part. Beginning with the cause of enlightenment, and just try and explain how the concept of freedom, the concept of freedom gets determined through these debates, and where I think the important moves are. So, Spinoza and Leibniz. The issue for the philosophical issue for Spinoza and Leibniz is how to make free will compatible with determinism. And you know, there's all these arguments about compatibilism in the philosophy of mind and political philosophy, and to be honest, I actually think most of those debates are fairly interesting. I'm more interested in Spinoza and Leibniz because what they're interested in is how to make free will compatible with the principle of sufficient reason, right? Because they are the two great thinkers of the principle of sufficient reason. Everything has a reason for why it is, including everything I have ever done or ever will do. Right? So, in that context, how can we talk about those things that I'm doing being free actions, in some sense? Now, basically, there are two different responses to it. Spinoza's conception of freedom is self-causation. Or, basically, it's the idea of your actions coming out of your own essence rather than kind of constraints placed upon that essence from the outside. This sort of, again, you can see this is like an initial attempt to think this kind of positive-negative binary, right? Spinoza thinks that because we are situated within a world, the things that we would naturally do are constrained from the outside, and well, he thinks ethically our imperative is to increase our positive freedom, so like positive capacities, cognitive, right? He thinks we have to maximise our positive capacities and minimise things that are imposed upon us from outside. And this idea of acting in accordance with one's essence as being, it's like a certain kind of self-derived necessity as being the essence of freedom, is expanded all the way up to God. So in Spinoza, there's only, like, God is not constrained by anything, right? God isn't constrained by anything from the outside, which means that God's essence just expresses itself in the world, right? All the modes come out of substance, and it could never be any other way, right? Like, there is only one way the world could ever possibly be. There's only the actual world, right? And this is still a free expression, because it is God's essence doing what it should do. It's God being who he is in, or she is, or it is, or whatever, in expressing itself in the world. Now, Leibniz takes issue with this, because Leibniz's conception of God is fundamentally more psychic, really. You know, for Leibniz, God is a monad amongst monads, not the substance underlying laws. And this means that Leibniz thinks we can, in a certain sense, think about God as a mental creature in the way that we are mental creatures. And for him, this means that if God's going to be free, right, there has to be some sense in which he could create a different world. There has to be some sense in which God had a range of options open to him, right, and he picked this one. And of course, this produces a great problem for Leibniz, which is, why did God pick this one? Like, why this one in which, you know, these horrible disasters have been going on, and like we have capitalism and any particular bad, evil things you want to blame the world. Why did God pick the world in which these things happen? And Leibniz's answer is, of course, that this is the best of all possible worlds. It just is. There's something more interesting there, but it's the best of all possible worlds because. This secures God's benevolence. So, this kind of produces an interesting sort of tension in Leibniz, insofar as on the one hand you have this idea of, well, God is of his essence, is omnipotent, so he can do anything. But on the other hand, he chooses to do this particular thing. And you go, well, why does he choose to do that particular thing? Well, because he's benevolent. Well, is that part of his essence? And if that's part of his essence, doesn't that mean he's kind of necessitated to produce the best of all? And so you have this kind of implicit contradiction in Leibniz here. But the important thing is that what you get in this opposition, that this kind of very grand opposition between conceptions of the freedom of God, is a certain conception of the relationship between freedom and necessity being worked out at its limit. And what you have in Leibniz is a kind of defense of the idea that, implicitly to some extent, that freedom requires some sort of ontological ground. And that ontological ground is conceived as a kind of interruption of the causal order. Like, I mean, in the case of Leibniz as God, it's not an interruption per se, it's the instantiation of the causal order, but it's still outside of the causal order. Like, God isn't situated within the world, and so that the reasons why God picks this world rather than that world can't themselves be understood in terms of the causal chains going on in the world. Right? And so this opposition between a conception of freedom in which it's tied to necessity, tied to determinism. Right, so this is the interesting thing about Spinoza, right? Spinoza isn't a compatibilist in the sense that is often talked about in most kind of sort of political philosophy, because Spinoza's point isn't that freedom is compatible with determinism. It's that freedom is, like, freedom requires determinism. Freedom is, like, to be free is to be determined in the right way. Right? It's not a question of being subtracted from the determination of the world, at least not entirely. Whereas Leibniz's conception is this kind of subtraction. Right? It takes writ large. Like, so only really God is free at the end of the day in Leibniz. But at least he's free in the sense that he has options, right? Now, interestingly enough, for those of you who are interested in Mises' work, I think the best way of looking at Mesu is as kind of a revision of Leibniz, in which he accuses Leibniz of cheating. So you know, there's the whole question: does God play dice? There's a certain sense in which, like, for Leibniz, yeah, God plays dice. He just cheats. the dice always lands on natural 20 for anyone who plays Dungeons and Dragons. And Mayer's response to Leibniz is basically, no, God is dice. Like, God's omnipotent. God is, like, this pure, in fact, it's a dice that's, like, transfinitely, you know, like, there can't be any determinate number of sides. But basically, Mayer resolves the tension between God's omnipotence and his benevolence in favour of his omnipotence. So you end up with a God without essence. God who has no benevolent essence. It's just, like, pure production of response. Which is why I think the other way of describing Mayasu is as kind of Lovecraftian. Like, his conception of hyperchaos is Azathoth. Right? The blind idiot God at the heart of creation. Random nuclear chaos. Anyway, that's just an aside. I'll put them on here. That means that may use anything. Right, okay. Now, what happens after Spinoza and Leibniz is that Kant turns up. And Kant is the lens through which this debate is diffracted. And the reason for this is that Kant, like, what Spinoza and Leibniz actually lack, really, is a criteria for distinguishing between causal chains that are actions and causal chains that are just events. So some things just happen, right? Like, I can trip over, right? I can be walking down the street and just trip over, and that's an action. But that's different from me choosing to, you know, dive onto the floor. There's an important difference between events and actions, and in fact the difference between agents and non-agents is the difference between things that, for some things that happen to them, these are actions, and those things for which nothing that ever happens to them is an action. Right? In the sense, it's not an action that they do. So what's Kant's criteria of demarcation? Fundamentally, it's this. Kant introduces this dimension of thinking about freedom, this rational dimension, insofar as for Kant, what distinguishes an action from an event is that you can treat an agent as being responsible for an action, whereas nothing is responsible for an event unless it's in some sense the product of an action. Right? But what does it mean to call an action someone responsible for an action? Right. What's the condition of that? Well, fundamentally, it's to say that there's some sense in which you can demand justification for it. You can demand reasons for the action, right? And this means that essentially, what it is to be an agent is to be a rational agent, in the sense of there has to be, you have to be capable of at least justifying some of your actions for any of your actions to count as actions. Right? If it was completely impossible for us to see some of your actions as happening for reasons that you in some sense understood, we couldn't understand you as that. Right? And there's a lot of kind of complicated questions here in terms of how you cash out this idea, and I'll go into that a little bit later. But that's the fundamental contribution that Kant makes to this debate and its itself. However, what Kant also does is he also has this thing in the dialectic at the end of the Critique of Pure Reason, where he says that fundamentally, in order to think ourselves as free agents, we have to think ourselves as noumenal, as our actions are somehow coming out of noumenal causation. And what he means by this is, like, there's an important sense in which regulatively, in order to engage in the process of practical reasoning, you have to just kind of treat yourself as this point out of which actions are, these causal chains are emerging. Right? You have to, in a certain sense, just not try and understand the causal processes through which you're actually engaging in the process of decision, and just make decisions. Right? Because if you got lodged in that, it would be a regress which leads nowhere, like a computationally intractable problem. The thing is, there's two ways of looking at this. One is this kind of regulative way of, like, look, it's just intractable to do otherwise. Like, you just have to sort of treat yourself as being a kind of a null point in the causal space, right? But the other way of looking at it is to say, well, there is some noumenal ground of freedom. There is necessary some metaphysical origin of autonomy that we must think properly in order to secure our freedom. And so the debate between Spinoza and Leibniz is refracted through Kant, because that idea of a kind of interruption of the causal chain is the Leibnizian strand of post-Kantian thought, and that which doesn't think we require this conception of kind of like indetermination, that which is happy to just think about the sense in which we as rational agents our actions are about being determined in the right way. That is this term. I previously called these authentically in vogue Kantianism. Some people object to this being called vogue. Let's just call these neo-Spinozists and neo-Leibnizians. Not all of them are aware they're neo-Spinozists and neo-Leibnizians, but this is the best way to organise the debate. How am I doing for time? Been on about 20 minutes. Okay. Right. The Spinozistic strain, we have Hegel, Marx, Salas, and Foucault. And on the other Leibnizian strain, we have Schelling, Heidegger, Sartre, Hegel, Zizek, and Mason. I know Ben will object to Schelling being over here to some extent, but maybe he'll say something about this later. The important thing is, these aren't all the same. These all represent different ways to attempt to think through this idea that we somehow need a metaphysical conception of freedom. Right? The distinction between the free and the non-free needs to itself be a metaphysical distinction. Right? And again, like, some of these people are very subtle in the way they think about things, but at the end of the day, what you get is, in Schelling, a sort of deep ontological ground of freedom, kind of somewhat analogous to Leibniz of God. In Heidegger, there's something similar like this in the later work with Leibniz, but in the early work, at least, you have this distinction between Dasein and non-Dasein. and it's viewed as an ontological distinction. Subtle as it is, it's quite interesting. It's still viewed metaphysically. And Sartre, this is kind of, and this is where Luca will probably disagree with me. I think this is kind of cruder than Heidegger. You get this distinction between the for itself and the in itself. And actually, I think this is fundamentally less interesting than Heidegger's distinction. And it's even more kind of metaphysically reified. In Bourdieu, you get this sort of strange desubjectivization, or rather resubjectivization of this issue, because subjects aren't necessarily people for these processes following truth procedures. But Bourdieu is very explicit in essentially, he's on the Leibnizian strand, but what he does is he thinks that the only way in which to secure freedom is to reject sufficient reason. Like his what he does is he rejects the principle of sufficient reason in order that we can think these kind of like spontaneous eruptions, that we can be, we have fidelity to, and that can lead to sort of political progress or epistemic progress or whatever. So again, this need to kind of make
the events,
to make freedom kind of metaphysical or supra-metaphysical. And Zizek, if you read him in certain, I know more through Adrian Johnson than through his own work, but again, he actually writes about this Kantian noumenal freedom, how like we really need to think that there is this kind of noumenal freedom in the human as opposed to the non-human. And again, it's all for this kind of political end of thinking that, well, there can't be these kind of ruptures from the cause of order as we understand them. And this is fundamentally anti-Spinozist, because for Spinozists, freedom comes from understanding. Like, understanding the cause of order more, right, will always provide enhanced freedom, separate paradox, but whereas there's an important sense in which, with like Zizek and Bourdieu, there's a kind of condition of freedom in suspending the suspicious reason. And then Mesu, I don't really want to say anything about Mesu's politics, I don't really know much about it, but like Mesu represents this kind of like almost like complete return of Leibniz in this kind of bizarre perverse where in which we have the omnipotent but non-benevolent God, who nevertheless will give birth to the child of the world of justice, and everything will be lovely, at least so we hope. On the other side, you have Hegel, Marx, Sartre, and Foucault. Now, Hegel again really picks up this Spinozistic idea of freedom as sort of self-determination, and as being freedom as being about necessity and constraint. But he synthesizes it with Kant's normative conception of autonomy. And this is sort of a main reason why I was getting people to read the Brandom, because it's a very, very good introduction to the sort of normative conception of Kantian autonomy. And Brandom there talks about positive normative freedoms. And they're sort of like positive notion. But and this is all that Hegel's about. Hegel's about how in fact we, through relations of reciprocal recognition, we constitute institutions socially that increase our freedoms individually and collectively. Like we bind ourselves into systems of social norms that in fact are enhancing, right? That's not to somehow constrain a prior ontological freedom that was there before. It's the constitution of freedom that wasn't there before. We become free by becoming involved within these social systems and becoming subjects through reciprocal recognition. There's lots of criticisms can be made about Hegel's particular ways of looking at this, that maybe, but it's an incredibly subtle and interesting issue of the sort. Marx takes this Hegelian framework and develops it further. But fundamentally, whereas Hegel, it just has this fairly abstract conception of institutions, and society is very holistic in Hegel, it's like society as a whole. Marx is very interested in the internal structure of society, and particularly in like the struggle between classes. the internal economic basic constitution through which these social relations and recognition and self-consciousness can emerge, and showing that these things have a kind of dynamic that can be elaborated and cause important social shifts. Let's take Hegel and Marx, Sellers and Foucault. I'm going to talk more about Sellers and then come back to this tradition. So I'll maybe leave out Sellers for now, just to say that basically what Sellers does is make Kant consistent. Sellers returns to Kant and basically gets rid of the numeral. He returns to Kant and he gets rid of not just the sort of residue of noumenal freedom in Kant, but also the residue of the noumenal God in Kant. In Kant, the noumenal is there not just to sort of secure our freedom, but it's also there to secure our souls and God, right? As being kind of transcendent and beyond the epistemic regime of empirical knowledge. Sellers just gets rid of all that and focuses on the account of rational agency and tries to develop it and make it more consistent. Foucault, this tradition is always more complicated than you think, but like Foucault actually has a real sort of important, like Foucault doesn't come out of Sellers, Foucault more kind of comes out of Kant and Nietzsche and Heidegger, but Foucault is definitely on this side.
Sorry, Courgette, maybe?
Alexandre Courgette? I don't know Courgette particularly well. I assume he'd be on the side of the table, but I also think it's really weird reading the table. I don't do it, so, you might see. Also, feel free at any point to kind of ask for a clear question about that. It's very helpful. Foucault, just like sort of Hegel and Marx, develop a kind of social version of the Kantian picture, and extend it and expand it and develop it. There's an important sense in which Foucault does the same, but via a slightly different direction. And that direction comes fundamentally through Heidegger. I will explain how that works, but it's just important to say something about Foucault here, because Foucault is probably my favourite thinker of freedom. I think he's the best and most subtle thinker of freedom in the 20th century, and this is particularly kind of like ironic, because kind of like the pre-boxed criticism of Foucault that you get from certain sides in philosophy is Foucault has no concept of freedom. Like Foucault is everything's power and everything's determination, and there's no room for the subject to emerge. Like Foucault has an incredibly rich and interesting conception of subjectivity and freedom. Right? And in fact, what Foucault emphasises, the deep of this sort of space that Foucault emphasises, which is very interesting, is a conception of quantitative, negative, rational freedom, which is nobody else really has talked about. So Foucault talks about freedom as a margin, something that can be increased or decreased. That's quantitative, right? And as we say, it's actually work upon yourself, construct yourself as to make yourself more free. What's a positive freedom to be done now? What's particularly interesting is his idea of constructing, he emphasises within this construction of making yourself more free, subtracting yourself from technologies of power, like social systems of technological domination through which you are constrained, and particularly through which not merely your actions are constrained in the sense of the abilities to do certain things are taken away from you, but your rational capacities to make choices and determine what to do with the other capacities are constrained. So Foucault defines power as action upon action, right? And the crucial element of that is constraining the way people think about themselves. That's form of subjectivity, right? And thus the way in which that way of thinking about themselves constrains the kinds of actions they're capable of performing, right? Foucault's self-construction, a project of self-construction, in maximising one's freedom, involves and emphasises this idea that socially we have to be able to free ourselves from certain ways of thinking, not just like ways of thinking in the abstract, but like systems of thinking that we're bound up in, that constrain our ability to run. This is, you know, resistance. Foucault is incredibly subtle and incredibly wonderful, and for anyone to say that Foucault has no concept of freedom is just completely ignored. Like, the essence of Foucault as an enlightened thinker. Right? But of course, many people don't think Foucault is very well. Right. Is everybody kind of basically happy with that conception of the dialectic? Does that make sense? Sorry.
Well, I'm not going to say that I'm happy because I think everyone would come up with a different thing, but it's a very convincing or like a coherent like way of describing like where you want to get to. Well, that's a lovely thing about philosophers, they always do their own history of philosophy. But that's not what I wanted to say, it's just to end with this question. There was one thing that you said in the beginning, and I was close to interrupting you, but it continued in my head, bothering me, or like I'm asking myself. You said something that I totally agree with, that some thinkers today, especially in the Spinozian tradition, I mean, that's where you started your analogy, they do not really make a distinction between, well, they say that everything has an agency, and thereby not really like confronting the problem or not really coming to a philosophical explanation. Now, I would totally agree with that on the philosophical level. But what you didn't explain, what I'm saying to myself is whether that's necessary politically to make this distinction, because that's what their claim is. You know, one should not make this distinction. And this is not, I mean, we are not proving them wrong by just saying they're not doing it. What they're saying, they don't want to do it. So,
I think it is necessary.
And you think it's necessary, but like what needs to be shown, like why it is necessary, and for what means. Is it necessary politically? I mean, philosophically, it is necessary. I want to make the distinction, and someone does make the distinction, well, it doesn't make it. But you know, that's not much said, you know? Because that's the fundamental disagreement. And maybe just to trace it to the first one of your theology or of your history of philosophy. I mean, the thing with Spinoza is you said the substance expresses like the modus or so, you know? Well, I mean, that's maybe your Hegelian or so reading, but as you know, this whole tradition that according to you reached Spinoza the wrong way or hasn't got a definition of agency and so on, they would say exactly the opposite, like Deleuze would do. No, it's the modes that are expressive, and not the substance. So here you have a completely different model. This is not just a philosophical, like a debate about like the history of philosophy positions, but it's very important when you think about like what's expressive and what expression means, because. The whole point in Spinoza is that there are different attributes. So I don't know whether you know like Spinoza, but like there's a substance and there are all these modes, and they are expressed or expressive via two attributes. That is, tell me if it's wrong. One is like thinking, and the other one is extension. So these are not like two universes, but these are two ways of seeing everything that happens. Right? So we are completely beyond this question of Spinoza vitalist thinker that describes everything as an agency, or is a rationalist thinker. But everything can be seen as in this attributal form of body or thinking. And that is the strong argument for why everything has an agency, even if it doesn't think. So I'm just saying that if you leave that out, you know, then what understanding of Spinoza is there? And, you know, like if you don't describe like the logic within Spinoza or how Spinoza thinks, it's easy to come up with this genealogy.
I'll add an extra hour on to Deleuze, etc. To like Negri and that sort of stuff, but also to some extent.
I want
to
be in the middle.
But there is. Like I'm seeing this debate as refracted through can, right? And of course, there are all sorts of physicists who bypass can. And they generally fall into that roof tendency, as Armin has pointed out, that everything has agency. And this is because there is an important sense in Spinoza in which everything has agency. It's canopus, right? And so, right, the interesting thing about Spinoza is he attempts to derive his ethical position, which is fundamentally about maximization of freedom, from what he thinks is an ontological principle, right? Which is that everything has an essence which gives it its power, right? And everything should strive to empower itself through freeing that essence from things that constrain it. There's a variety of ways in which this has been done. I know Deleuze is better. And Deleuze, you say that, like, oh, there's this whole idea of there's substance turning around in wounds. It's important to recognise that that's a Deleuzean revision of Spinoza. It's not Spinoza. Spinoza is very, you know, God is in Spinoza, it is. Right? It's a very interesting conception of God, but yeah, it's all of theology.
It's nature. No?
Yeah, it's nature. Yeah, but it is. It's still
it's not a rational agency.
Yeah.
It's nature.
But in Deleuze, he subtracts God. You move from substance to the plane of immanence, and the plane of immanence is not a thing. The plane of immanence has no essence. Right? The crucial thing is God has essence, like moments have essence. And that's how this is an analogy of freedom between in Deleuze there is. What Deleuze does with Guattari, of course, is to try and perform a similar ontological grounding of ethics. Right? And it's important to sort of say that the whole Spinozist project of this ontological grounding of ethics is a reaction to Aristotelianism. So, like, Aristotelianism is another ontological grounding of ethics. But in Aristotelianism, it's through final causation. And everything has different final causes. Everything has different purposes in the world, as bequeathed by the prime mover. So, like, God basically says, this is what this should do, this is what this should do, this is what this should do. And that's ethics, kind of sorted out. In Spinoza, he tries to find a kind of univocal principle which underlies everything. Everything maximizes power or influence. It's not differentiated by types of things, everything. Deleuze's correction of Spinoza is essentially to try and remove this gesture from its dependence on essence. Because essence, for Deleuze, is fixed. And this is what he says in his interpretation of Spinoza. The cat has a kitten, and the cat has the old cat, have the same essence, even though it's kind of like been reconfigured a bit. But there are still kind of limits to what it could be. Like, there are transitions that the cat can undergo, which means it would not be the same thing anymore. Right? So you can't say it should become something else, because that wouldn't be a maximization of its power, because right? It wouldn't be it anymore. Right, so Deleuze and Guattari's Ethics of Becoming is all about trying to free this idea of self-constructive maximization of capacity from the last kind of remnants of sort of fixity in Spinoza. And so that in essence what they end up saying is, instead of become what you are, become this essence free exists, just maximize it, fulfill it, they end up sort of saying become other than you are, become other, become and what they mean by it really is actually very Nietzschean. This is the Nietzschean spinozistic synthesis. They want a conception of freedom in which the fundamental drive underlying everything, which we should normatively espouse, is the drive towards adaptability. You know, Nietzsche's becoming the child. Adapt to become more adaptable. And this is interesting, and it has parallels with what Foucault does, this idea of self-construction. Foucault thinks this self-construction is the formal, you know, we're looking at the formal end, which is self-mastery. Like, construct yourself so as to master yourself more, which is to say, be able to do more self-construction. right? So there's a certain parallel there, but the difference is precisely that I say the football is from the camp, international firms, and you're precisely right in saying that. So as Macari, and basically mostly of a, and I'd say slightly less subtle spenders to support them. Quick sidebar, I think like there is a tendency towards irrationalist spiritism, like trying to separate spiritism from rationalism, that I think is appalling, because like Spinoza is literally the only person in history who attempted an Euclidean deduction of ethics from axioms. I mean, this guy thought reason was really important. Like, you know, like, not just like a little bit, but like, really important. You know, like, and the whole idea of like reason as a way of enhancing our understanding of ourselves and nature and thereby empowering us. There was a crucial connection between reason and freedom, and in Spinoza it just wasn't quite worked out properly in my view. It needed a Kantian supplement. But a lot of the sort of non-Kantian spinozists in rejecting the Kantian supplement also reject the rational authority of Spinoza. They threw out a bit of the bathwater, and that's very, very problematic. I mean, I give a more detailed argument for why I think that fundamentally Spinoza himself doesn't, his own ontological grounding of freedom and normativity just doesn't work. And thus why these guys don't work, because they essentially pursue the same strategy and there's no way of making it fly. Really interesting guys, but it's not going to fly. I'll maybe come back to that in the question, because I need to kind of get off into...
You mentioned Foucault and freedom, and the things that, for me, he always reads very... in terms of freedom, very different. I would say that they, from talking sort of seemingly different dialectic from fearlessness, from parhesia, that the in a sense the subject or the element, whatever it is free if they are fearless, it doesn't really matter whether, say, you might think that the other person is oppressed or whatever. If they feel fearlessness, then they're free.
Well, I mean, I think that's only half true, because fear is an instrument of power. Right? Fear is an incredible form of action upon action. Right? If you impose fear successfully upon a population,
if you don't have it.
You prevent them.
So, in a sense, the question of freedom is the question of the existence or lack of fear.
No, it's not just that, though, because there are cases in which, as I say, like resisting technologies of control will be resisting the imposition of fear. Right? But, as we're all aware, not all forms of control are ever led through fear. Some forms of control are, in fact, implemented through the suppression of fear. Right, some forms of control are implemented through making you incautious in ways that you probably should be a bit more cautious. Right, you should maybe be a bit more cautious about what you're spending there. You know, maybe you don't get into quite so much debt. I'm going to be fine. So the idea of it, fear being the key is wrong. It's an instance. It's interesting. Worth thinking about, but not fear.
But one thing I would say, which I think is interesting about Schelling's relationship to, is he actually critiques the reading of nominal freedom in the Freedom Essay. It's basically saying, the problem is how can you say freedom has a nominal cause, but then say that in itself is then from the dynamics of nature or something. So it's like, But then if you want that to be a cutoff point, you just want that to be a regular function, you know, comes, and that's fine, but then how does that relate more elaborately to the practical philosophy later? So that's kind of the Schelling. So I think, and I kind of said this yesterday, I think about Schelling's relationship to Kant is a bit. But the other thing I just wanted to say in terms of your diagram, and obviously we could expand this forever, but I thought about it when you said how some of the people on the right wouldn't see themselves necessarily as right, as one on that side. And it seems largely, or that might be largely due to the fact of the, you know, it's the Kojev elite split, interpretation of Hegel, because the Kojev's Hegel is generally Kant's Hegel, and that kind of, I think, feeds, that kind of explains maybe why there's the, you know, people on the Leibniz side who think they're on the other side.
That is an interesting point.
So if you were going to put Kojev in the diagram, it would be kind of sort of here, going out of Hegel, and then you'd be feeding in like sort and the Jew.
And then
we are transitioning back from this side of this.
Yeah, so it would be on that sort of, the Ebelis,
Anyway, okay, any more questions about the rough historical dialectic before I move on? Because I probably only have like 20 minutes left to explain. We'll see. Any other? No? Okay, fine. So, historical dialectic. Let's zoom in to this side. Let me begin with Sellers. I said that essentially what Sellers does is to revise Kant. There are a couple of ways in which he does this. I summarized it by saying he gets rid of the numeral, basically. But the more interesting thing is to see how he appropriates and develops Kant in transcendental psychology. So a lot of people, when they hear the phrase transcendental psychology, basically think, well, that's like empirical psychology, just wrong. It's like attempting to do empirical psychology without any actual empirical work. So, it's just wrong. This is what P.F. Strawson says in his book on Kant, which is awful. But actually, what was Kant trying to do? My basic guiding principle is that what Kant was trying to do was essentially artificial general intelligence. We talked about this yesterday. Right? Kant basically was trying to give a completely abstract picture of what it is for something to be a rational agent, analogously to what Turing did with effective computation in providing a kind of Turing machine. Right? It's abstract, transcendental, precisely in the sense that you can make a Turing machine out of anything. It's just a functional diagram. Right? You can instantiate it in whatever you want. Just about. Resonance talked yesterday, probably not this little bit. But anyway, Kant was trying to do the same thing. This is why when Kant talks about faculties, you should just read information processing system. Right? You're talking here synthesis, you should just read information processing. Right? What delineates the different faculties is the kinds of information they operate on. Right? Your understanding is about concepts, reasoning is about inference and inferential principles. Sensibility, which includes imagination, is about sensory information. He's interested in how all these things tie together to create a rational agent. And fundamentally, what's the essence of the rational agent for him? It's that ability to justify one's actions. Right? And at the core of that, essentially, is the judgment, right? So, and this is why I got people to read Brandon, because Brandon is very, very good at showing how Kant breaks with the previous tradition of logic and thinking about thought, because he shows that what Kant does is to prioritise the judgment. Not the terms, not the concept like dog or the individual like fire, but the judgment fire as a dog, right? He's an awfully simple example. So any system that's going to be able to be counted as a rational agent has to be able to make judgments and has to be able to understand them, right? Can't just be a system for emitting sentences. It's got to be able to grasp those sentences. In order that it can essentially provide those reasons for its action, so it can. And again, like some people think that this position boils down to saying that, well, every action in order to be an action needs to be the result of practical reasoning. Like, everything I do has to be a syllogism. Like, so I'm going to take a sip of water, and I'm like, well, thirsty, thing there, and therefore, you know, you get this paper. That's not the case. It's simply like the converse. If I could never engage in practical syllogism, right, there's no useful sense in which any of my actions could count as actions. Right, it's a certain connection between the two that constitutes rational agency, that the ability to retrospectively formulate and articulate one's I'll get into how this relates to other people in a soon. The important thing is Kant's interested in articulating the functional structure of what something has to have in order to make judgments, to act on the basis of those judgments, to provide those reasons. And the Brandon I got for you to read, which everybody of course did read, I'm certain of, explains this in large part. What it means to be a rational agent for Kant fundamentally comes down to being able to undertake commitments, both theoretical and practical. Commitments to the truth of certain propositions or judgments, and commitments to enact that truth. So the ability to both say that, you know, someone has climbed Everest, and the ability to go from the commitment to climbing Everest, right, to trying to climb Everest. Sellers makes all of this a lot clearer. What Sellers does is essentially... So another word for judgment, there are two different words here, would be proposition. And sentence. Right? So this, the judgment, comes from the tradition when they're just thinking about thought, qua thought, and they're not really interested in language. Proposition is, again from there, proposition is understood as the content of the judgment, right? Sentence is linguistic. It's what we use to express propositions, at least in declarative sentences, right? This is a kind of syntactic notion. This is a semantic notion. What Sellers does is go, well, let's think about propositions in terms of sentences. Right, let's start off with language, because we can really understand what the pragmatics for manipulating these things are there. We can understand the functional structure of systems that have to engage in language, right? And then we can sort of extract systems that can deal with propositions from that. And what he does is, if you think of it, you've got a system between sentential and non-sentential inputs and outputs, right? So let's call this the distinction between sentential and non-sentential, right? Here, this gives you four different kinds of inputs and outputs you can have, right? So you can have sentence to non-sentence, right? What's that? That's action, right? Or at least in a certain sense, because we can see this in systems that don't have rational capabilities. So I can say, fetch the stick boy, right? And you can fetch the stick in a certain sense. You know, there are limited examples of abilities to transit from sentences to actions that aren't part of the whole thing. Then you've got sentence to sentence. What's that? That's inference. You've got non-sentence to sentence. That's perception. And these are the three that Sellers concerns himself with. He's interested in understanding systems as, so if I put it in a different order, right, we can say, if you put it in a different order, what you get is sort of nonsense, sentence,
right?
Perception, action, right? What he's interested in is describing systems that can be enacted on by the world. They can have sensation, right? And this.
Sorry, would nonsense just be
an
act?
I'm going to get to that. Because it's the thing that Sellers is really talking about. So,
one of the arrows is backwards.
Is it? Oh, yes, it is, right.
No problem.
Sellers is interested in a rational system as something which can do all three of these things, and in which they are appropriately connected. It's something, it's a system that doesn't really sense and behave. It senses stuff from its environment and then behaves in its environment. It's a system which perceives, right? Which is to say, it then undertakes a position within the space of reasons. It commits itself to certain beliefs, right? And then on the basis of that beliefs, modulates its behaviour, which is to say, acts. Right, that arc, right, is the sort of the rational agency arc, right, rather than a pure reflex arc. Right. Now the thing that Sellers doesn't really address is this. And that's what Luke was saying there. I call this coping, following Heideggerian language. This is what Heidegger is interested in. Heidegger is interested in the fact that most of our actions aren't syllogisms. Most of our actions don't come out of practical reasoning. Most of our actions are just coping with things in the world. The important thing is that Heidegger also has this notion of interpretation, which is to say that it's not just that we stuff happens and we react to it, but actually we can modulate what we do. Like we can interrupt our behaviours and our habits and alter them and change them. And part of this is we can interrupt and engage in practical reasoning. We can go like, oh, wait a minute. Should I, put the cheese in first, or should I leave it till the end? I love cooking as a great example of practical reasoning. And you might go, well, check it out on the internet. Some pros, some cons. There are ways of interrupting this, and basically those interruptions are that arrow there. And this, if you think about it properly, is incredibly Kantian, because Kant's fundamental idea, beyond the kind of methodological focus on judgment, is consciousness. Kant's conception of consciousness is not about awareness in the sense of like being awake, having experience. What Kant means by consciousness is this. You are, and his definition of consciousness is something is conscious, a representation is conscious, if there is the possibility of it becoming self-conscious. Right? And that's what this is. That's the transition to self-consciousness. Right? It's, so, in Heideggerian terms, like, I'm going about coping, just engaging within things practically, I'm thinking about completely different things, and then I catch myself, I hit a problem that I need to deploy reasoning in order to solve. Right? That's moving from those things which are conscious to a self-conscious state. And the self-consciousness consists in the rational capacities. Right? The things that I was doing before I went into those rational capacities were conscious because there was the possibility of them going into that. Right? Whereas there are other things that my body does habitually. Right? Like I regulate my own temperature, except I don't do it really. Right? My body does. There's no way I can consciously control it. I can't interrupt it. Right? Maybe there are some people who can. Like, and they've, you know, their awareness of their embodied temperature is conscious. Their action upon it is conscious. Right? But for me, it's not because it can't become self-conscious. So the fundamental link between consciousness and self-consciousness is a kind of foundational Kantian principle. Right. Okay. I'm just going to keep going on and eventually we will get questions. Right. That's Sellers.
And you were asking about break because you wanted.
Yeah, I'll have a break once I finish the story and tell it. And then you come back, you can think. Everything will be fine. is everybody roughly comfortable with this story about the redevelopment of Kant? Ish. Kantianian, you know, processing systems, sentences, non-sentences. Yeah.
Can I have a quick question on that? Do you think Kant is attempting the description? I realize that it's a kind of, it's an appropriate reading of the history of philosophy to describe Kant as a theorist of artificial intelligence. Do you think this project for Kant is, it seems to me for Kant it's primarily descriptive, whereas today when we talk about a theory of intelligence that is oriented towards the development of theory of general artificial intelligence, the idea of artificial intelligence implies a constructive and like intent.
I think it's already prescriptive in Kant because it's fundamentally a description of norms. Like it's a description of a normative structure.
Right.
So it sits on that dividing line, that's the transcendental. Right. And I think this is obviously an appropriate reading. But it's not that appropriate. And the reason I say this is because, okay, Kant never says anything about artificial intelligence, because no one says anything about artificial intelligence at the time, really. But Kant does say things about aliens and angels. You know, like, Kant was really into his cosmology. Kant was very explicit that, like, my account of the mind has to be able to apply to aliens and angels, even if they have different forms of sensibility. Like, the forms of sensibility might change, but the form of intelligibility won't, right? And that's the... Now, what's interesting about Sellers is Sellers basically tries to take out that variable element. Like, but the account of perception is an attempt to just kind of bypass the question of the form of sensibility. Not completely to eliminate it, just to be able to talk about the transition from sensation to conception in general enough terms that they could be applied to any images, if you want. Does that make?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just quickly, in the account you give of Sellers, you're saying you're basically importing a Heideggerian notion of consciousness and self-consciousness?
No. The account of consciousness and self-consciousness is Kantian, but I just think Heidegger provides you with the last wall of
I just was wondering if there's any consequences of essentially crossing the stream between those spikes, because it's likely to see a placement.
Okay, yeah. I've got to get to this.
Okay.
Okay, I'm about to get to that. So let's get there. So, the dialectic part two. or in fact, Ron, this time it's impossible. Because, so we start with Kant, right? Let's say we start with Kant this time. So Kant gives us an account of individual rational agency, and Sellers refines that account. Right? So this is a way of going back to Kant and rethinking about it. What about the social world? Right? And there are fundamentally two different streams of thinking about the social that emerge from Kant. Right? And these are Hegel and Marx. And Heidegger and Foucault. And this sort of should say that, like, again, the this is intended to be accurate rather than entirely me, because you've got to acknowledge that Heidegger is, in some sense, not in the Spinozist tradition, right? But we can bring it in. We can drag it in and scream it against his own will. So, what distinguishes these two sides of the Kantian tradition in thinking about social? Okay, did you think here? This is self-consciousness. Collective self-consciousness. And this is collective consciousness. And let me explain this. What's the big? I mean, Brandon gives a really interesting reconstruction of Hegel and this whole conception of mutual recognition and how that leads into the constitution of institutions and the conceptual domain and whatnot. Well, what really is Hegel's sort of like big, interesting, innovative extension of Kant? Well, what Hegel realises essentially is that if Kant's account of rational agency is so abstract that it can be instantiated in anything, you can instantiate it in rational agents. Like, you can get a group of rational agents and you create a new rational agent out of them. It's recursive. What's that? That's spirit. Right? Collective self-consciousness. Right? However, as I said before, Hegel's conception of this collective self-consciousness is fairly totalizing and homogenous. Not completely, but like he thinks of society as a whole. Right? What Marx does is to really differentiate, to give us an account of how you can have groups within societies that form their own kinds of collective self-consciousness through their sharing of needs, through having common needs, and this can be expressed politically, and those political expressions can form kind of class relations, which are struggles, which, you know, lead to social dynamics, right? This is a kind of a complete and a more partial view of social structures in terms of collective self-consciousness. Heidegger and Foucault. Heidegger, what's fantastic in Heidegger's thought is he presents us with an account of collective consciousness that is not self-consciousness. So Heidegger's conception of world is basically a collective practical workspace, right? I mean that in a computational sense, right? What the world is a collective repository of heuristics for acting, right? And it's constituted by the fact that we copy one another and improve one another. That the fact that we understand one another as engaging in the same things enough to the extent that simply by doing things we display new practical solutions to each other. And this constitutes a kind of sociocognition through which, collectively, we solve practical problems. Right? So the kind of development of the of culture through the kind of the strife of earth and world, right, in Heidegger, is this kind of continual process of sociocognitive evolution. And of course, Heidegger would hate that as a description of what he's doing, but it's what he's doing. And I don't care that he hated it. Foucault performs the same role in relation to Heidegger's Marxist inherit, which is to say, he differentiates the world. The world, the space of collective consciousness in Heidegger, is again unitary. It's attached to a vault, which is very unfortunate. But it lets you see why Heidegger was so interested in National Socialism. Foucault gives us this account of differentiated practical systems. Technologies of power, but also technologies of resistance, like actual how groups of agents come together and form socio-cognitive systems within the social sphere, which are not themselves self-conscious. So the best example of this is actually not Foucault, but some very, very Foucauldian researchers who, inspired by him, studied, they put out a book called Priests and Programmers, where they studied water temple rituals in Barbie. And what they showed was that these elaborate systems of religious rituals through which they coordinated when they were going to open up the fields to water and when they closed them were actually an optimization algorithm. I mean, no one who was doing any of this stuff was aware of it, but they developed collectively an optimization algorithm for minimizing pests in their fields. And when the WTO came in, they made them kind of rationalize their farming practices and completely and utterly screwed things up. They had a massive pest problem because they just did erase that traditional socio-cognitive solution that had been developed. What Foucault gives you is the extension of the Kantian conception of transcendental psychology into a full-blooded transcendental sociology. Right? So the account of power is an abstract account of the relation between rational agents, because the account of rational agents is abstract. Okay, I think that's probably about as much as I should really do. But I just want to close by saying, once you see all this stuff, you can start thinking about extending the Salazian functional picture into it. So the question becomes, well, okay, how do we study socio-cognitive systems in the Heideggerian Foucauldian world? How do we study them? How do we see how they work as information processing networks? As essentially coping systems, you know, the non-sentential and non-sentential. And then how do we use the insights of Hegel and Marx into the structure of social self-consciousness to think about creating institutions and, you know, other kinds of social forms that can make that consciousness self-conscious. Which isn't to say replace it, but enable it to interrupt itself and reflect on itself and correct itself. Right? That is how we deal with the problem of collective freedom. Right? We take the Spinozistic idea of maximizing our freedom individually, and we try and translate it into an idea of maximizing our freedom collectively. And it is a project of self-mastery. A lot of people have problems with this coming out of the Accelerationist Manifesto, because they think you can't take the connotations of the word mastery out of coloniality. But Foucault uses self-mastery because it comes out of Nietzsche in that sense, right? It's a conception of self-control, which is to say self-consciousness, right? And the problem with collective freedom has to be about constituting collective self-consciousness. This comes back to Alan's point about the Spinozist tradition, the counter-Spinozist tradition, is that in neglecting rational capacities, they neglect collective rationality. say, the condition of collective self-consciousness, which is something that Spinoza himself didn't. Like, the political treaties is about this stuff, but, you know, a lot of people think that you can just use Spinoza to get pure affectivity and everything will be fine. That's a bit of a gross caricature, but you get where I'm coming from. Right, so, yeah, freedom. It's important. questions?
Is the freedom it?
Is freedom what?
You said freedom, it's important.
Yeah.
Is it an it? How do you know if you know it?
I mean, it is just an anaphoric pronoun. It's just like everything is an it, because anything we can talk about can be an it. It is just a pointing with it that then we talk about.
You use it as the word talk about.
Well, do you mean is freedom a thing in the sense of a concrete, like that? No. It's not. It's universal. Right? But then we get into this question of what universal is in the back of metaphysics, you know, what we were talking about yesterday. I just think freedom is an ideal.
All right, you do see it as an ideal.
Yeah, it's an ideal.
All right.
But okay, here's an important kind of qualifier, right? So I'm in many ways a Platonist, you know, so sue me. But where I think Plato goes wrong in a variety of different ways. I don't like endorse the metaphysics or any of this stuff, but I think there's something important about the ideas, particularly the normative ideas: truth, goodness, beauty, things like that, justice, right, freedom, ideals like this. Where Plato goes wrong is Plato treats these as archetypes, which is to say, so the idea of justice is the archetype of justice, the perfect state. It's like a map for constituting a perfect state. And we all know what goes wrong there, right? The alternative to seeing ideals, another thing I'd say is that a lot of people have hostility to the idea of truth. They come from from this archetypal angle where they're like, but you can never get to the final truth. You can never get to the perfect, complete system of the world. Of course we can't. Like, yeah, no, I agree. Right? Does that mean we should stop thinking about truth? No. Like, because truth is an ideal. And what it is to understand these things as ideals is to understand them as procedures. Like, they're normative procedures that we have to undergo and that are iterable and indefinite. Right? You never get to get out of the problem of justice. But neither is it a kind of Levinasian infinite responsibility that can't be really articulated at all. No, we can articulate it, it's just we can never get outside of it. Right? So there's justice is a concrete task, truth is a concrete task, it's one of engaging in the process of undertaking commitments and revising them and discussing them and developing and just getting better. Right? It directs us in a certain way, it orients us. Good, we're talking about navigation. And the same is true of freedom. Freedom, on the one hand, is an abstract diagram, an abstract functional structure, right, which enables us to distinguish between agents and non-agents. But on the other hand, it's a blueprint, right, for improving and self-improvement and becoming more free, right, which isn't just about acquiring more actual capacities, more things we can do, but acquiring more rational capacities, which enable us to understand and do those things better. You can become more free, not simply through acquiring more things you can do, but developing one's ways of thinking about it. And that task itself can be both positive and negative. It can be both a kind of transhumanist task of self-advancement through developing our species being, but it can also be a Foucauldian task of deconstructing or analysing and taking apart and resisting the sociological mechanisms that impede our ability to be rational. That's those are the elements of the ideal of freedom.
Can you go back on the previous dialectic just so I can ask a question?
Yeah.
Where would you, or if you could elaborate a bit more about the... I was wondering where the functionalist account of the autonomy of reason would fit in the dialectic. I know the sources of it, obviously, in terms of...
You want to go to the first dialectic, right?
Yes. Just in terms of thinking of the way in which you... You expose, I mean, Leibniz in one way, in terms of the freedom of the, in relation to the options that are available. And in the case of Spinoza, freedom is precisely that your essence is adequate, and the adequation of that essence is precisely what enables freedom. So I was wondering, because there's something about the functionalist gesture that is a bit arbitrary in that case. So I was wondering if you could say a bit more about that.
Okay. Well,
in terms of like the post-Kantianism of, in a way, you know, the Brandonian, like, giving...
Well, do you mind if I go back pre-Kantian?
Sorry?
Do you mind if I go even further back?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
Okay,
so just, yeah, I'm just asking for a more elaboration.
Okay, well, if I see if I can get an issue. If you want to go even further back, we'll zoom out. let's go to Socrates now. So, Socrates, Socrates, as far as I'm, basically the way I see Socrates is completely non-metaphysical. All of the kind of metaphysical stuff is Plato through Socrates. If you read Xenophon's Socrates, he is very much more practical and very much in that... He's the origin of that Greek tradition of philosophy, which sees philosophy as a practical activity. It's concerned with the good life. It's concerned with virtue and wisdom. And virtue and wisdom are fundamentally normative concepts, right? So whenever people say, like, all this normativism stuff, that's just kind of like modern and Pittsburgh and all this kind of thing. That's got nothing to do with the history of philosophy. No, go back to Socrates. Socrates is like die-hard normativist, right? He's not interested in your metaphysics. He's interested in your virtue, right? Socrates in your virtue, right? As well, because of wisdom, you know, Socrates is concerned with the normativity of thought itself, the normativity of discourse, and thinking properly. Not just with living properly, but thinking properly. These two things are essentially inseparable. You know, virtue is wisdom. So we should trace the origin of thought about the normative here, at least in the Western tradition. The question is, well, what happened to Plato? Well, on the one hand, something really good, and on the one hand, something really bad. Plato is the first to really express the idea of the autonomy of reason. Right, so Plato basically treats reason as sui generis, right, of its own genus. Right, it's not part of nature. Right, this is why you get the interpretation of forms as a separate world. They are not to be grounded in nature. The best expression of this is still, for me, the Euthyphro, where Socrates challenges Euthyphro and says, you know, well, is this pious because the gods say it's pious? Or is it, you know, do the gods say it's pious because it's pious? And that's the initial gesture of articulating the independence of the normative ideal. Like, is the good... good because of something within nature that determines of it, or is it just good in itself? Is the good, you know? And Plato, you know, so Plato in a certain sense heightens Socrates' normativism. The problem is that he then makes this tiny little gesture in a certain sense, which just is responsible for a lot of what happens in the history of philosophy later. So, what I call the Platonic knot, this is an idea developed with Greg Brassier, We've never actually published it. But the idea is that essentially Plato's gesture is, he goes, in fact, reason is so independent of nature that nature is founded on reason. Like, the form of the good is the origin of nature. And you go, oh, so close. And so he reconnects the two. Even if the intelligible has priority, that connection, that not fundamentally just progresses through the history of philosophy and there you get Aristotle. What happens with Aristotle? Aristotle takes that relation and switches the priority so that now you have to have a theology, which is the foundation of your normative thought. So you have to have a metaphysical conception of nature, which is the ground for your normative stuff. And that's what I was saying earlier. Like Aristotle, Aristotle has this, you know, the doctrine of final causation. And final causation is fundamentally grounded in the prime mover as the both the causal origin but also the final end of everything. And basically this is the origin of theology proper and theism really in the kind of like in its self-conscious monotheistic form. Because when you connect the good to a certain metaphysical conception, so one way in which people read Plato and Platonic kind of forms of religion is to say the form of good is God. Like, God is not another than the form of good. But as soon as you say that, you open up the possibility of arguing that, well, this thing is good because God's essence is. Right? You in opening up that border of metaphysics, you enable metaphysics to have normative consequences. And Aristotle is like the real kind of like point at which that becomes that little gesture in Plato becomes huge. Because suddenly you have not just a ground of creation, you have what Nietzsche would call an ascetic ideal. Like a really consistently articulate ascetic ideal in which you have a single ground of all forms of value. Now, Spinoza and Leibniz. Spinoza and Leibniz can be seen as taking two different sides of Aristotle and prioritizing them. So basically it's the debate between efficient and final causation. Spinoza is on the side of efficient causation. Spinoza wants to get rid of final causation. Right? He's very explicit about this. Really explicit about this. This is why he's the god of the Endonicians in a certain sense. Right? He has the god of the Endonicians. Which isn't to say he gets rid of the link between the normal and the natural. In fact, he intensifies it in a certain sense. Instead of having this typology of final causes, you get this, well, there's just one final cause and it's maximize yourself through your essence, right? Maximize your freedom through expressing your essence. So it's neat. It's really impressive. It is an anti-Aristotelian gesture, but unfortunately, it's still within the Platonic norm. Leibniz basically prioritizes final causation, and you know, like for Leibniz, space-time and causation is epiphenomenal.
But you could also say that Spinoza prioritizes final cause to the extent that, you know, the question of your adequation and your empowerment of that is itself a sort of like theoretic.
No, it is. He just generalizes theology instead of having it's a way of thinking about it. Is it's univocal theology? Mm-hmm. There's only one end. Everything has the same, the same individual end indexed to itself. Mm-hmm. So it's like a super minimalist theology. It's still theology. Whereas Leibniz is, it's basically just like massive theology. I mean, hell, the best of all possible worlds. How more teleological can you get? Okay. Kant. Right. There's a certain sense in which Kant goes back to Socrates and Plato, What Kant does is to at least attempt to sever the Platonic knot. So, the crucial thing here is, again, we're focusing on teleology. The crucial thing is the third critique, the critique of teleological judgment. And basically, what Kant does there is to say, look, there are no ends in nature. Teleology has no metaphysical valence. It is simply regulative. We need to posit ends in order to understand things. That's like the advanced form of that idea is what Rez's presentation was yesterday. The full working out of that particular form of thinking. Right? What he says essentially is that what he means by it being regulative is to say that it's analogous. We understand ends in nature as analogous to practical reason. And to bring in some Salazian terms that help explain this, essentially what he, there's two different kinds of way of viewing normativism. One is ought to do. And neither is ought to be. Right? And the debate between Kant and Aristotle, right, that's the real kind of opposition. Right? The debate between Kant and Aristotle is over which of those is primary. So in Aristotle, ought to be is primary. Right? You have final causes, and then you work out action, ought to do on the basis of that. So man's final cause is eudaimonia, so that tells you what you're supposed to do. Kant, we understand all to do primarily, we understand practical reason, and we make an analogy to functional systems in the world in order to understand them. Right? And this is something which is worked out a bit more by Sellers, and it's something which working out that analogy is the difficult issue. Like, working it out is severing the Platonic knot. And it's not easy, because you get this issue where, wait a minute, didn't I just explain reason functionally? And didn't I just give a functionalist account of reason? And now I'm saying you need to understand functional rationality in terms of practical. Isn't that circular? It's not. It's expressively circular in the way we mentioned yesterday. But demonstrating that, showing how it's kind of like a bootstrapping process is difficult. So that's the rough sort of story. Kant severs the Platonic knot, and that's why the refraction of the debate between Spinoza and Leibniz through Kant is important.
I find it interesting, the thing to me that is interesting, the functionalist account is, on the other hand, like a functional autonomous gesture of autonomization in philosophy claims as something arbitrary and weak. And what follows from that is a kind of like heavy commitment, almost to kind of using. I just find it like just noting that.
Okay.
So that's a sort of like asymmetrical balancing.
Yeah.
I'm noticing that just to make that explicit.
No, that's fine, that's fine. I can dig it. I can dig it.
Yeah.
By the way, do people like a toilet coffee break? We don't have that much time left, but or you carry on, you can finish early. People prefer that. Do that, and I finish like 1:15, and then we get a bit longer of a lunch break.
Or we can have an earlier lunch break.
That's early. Finish.
It's an inclusive or.
Okay, that's another option. We could break now and come back early.
Where?
But, like, you want to talk more about freedom?
Let's keep going.
Lunch is half an hour break now, and then we continue half an hour, and then we have the break between 1 and 2. Or we have break now for 1.5 hours and we start at 1:30 instead of 2. Is that these are the two options, right?
I just remembered that Nick is supposed to respond to me, so he's. I just saw him going there, like, I don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
Almost, the poker face almost had me. But yeah, Nick said he.
I can respond now, or I can respond on voice.
No, do respond now, because
yeah, let's keep going now.
But I might not do one.
No one else?
I'll
sit for them. Who's going to decide? We all have to decide ourselves.
So I'll make this pretty quick because I think we do want to talk about what we want to eat and everything. I can use some coffee. So I guess my first sort of point, I think, we were discussing this the other night over drinks. But I think the sort of dominant idea of freedom we have culturally today is the sort of idea of negative freedom, particularly liberal sort of ideas of negative freedom. Whether it be sort of classic liberalism or more neoliberal idea, they're both about negative freedom. So freedom from the state, I mean, that's sort of embodiment of natural rights and the sort of natural laws embodied in the market. We're supposed to be free to go along with these things, but withdrawing state power. I think sort of the interesting aspect about the idea sort of circulating around accelerationism is precisely to put this idea of positive freedom back on the debate and really push for this as being the central notion of what properly sort of leftist politics should be. And I think this is very much in Marx as well. I sort of forgot this idea that Marx doesn't say much about what a communist society would actually look like. But he does actually say some very specific things about what it would look like. And what they happen to be is things about free time, so decreasing the working day, but also increasing the capacity to do what you want to do. So the sort of famous idea of going fishing in the morning, doing something else in the afternoon, critiquing stuff at night. It's this idea that we should be able to be free to do as many things as we want to possibly do. There's also this aspect of the development of the productive forces, which is crucial to Marxism. It's this idea of building technology precisely in order to liberate us from scarcity so that we can do other things. I think this plays into, once you take that sort of tendency, it plays directly into cosmist ideas that Ben Singleton has discussed. And so I think that, it's quite interesting to sort of put these ideas about accelerationism in line with positive ideas of freedom. But discussing sort of the distinctions that Pete put forth here, which I completely agree with and completely adopt in my own work, but I think there's sort of certain tensions involved in them as well, which are maybe sort of elided in the discussion so far. So this idea of the role of constraints within positive and negative freedom, this idea that actually, and Foucault's quite good on this, actually constraints can be productive of freedom. So this idea that actually positive and negative freedom aren't mutually exclusive, but actually you can use negative constraints to produce a positive freedom. And I think this sort of gets to Ben's ideas about traps and things like this. I quite like this metaphor that the trap is something that constrains you, but it also allows you to do other things, and you want to escape a trap in order to get into a better trap, as Ben puts it. So I think there's a sort of tension here between positive and negative freedom. They're not quite mutually exclusive, and we have to sort of make a decision about which one we want to emphasize. And also on the qualitative and quantitative sort of the tension between those two, the trade-offs between them. Again, the discussion of Marx. So when he talks about free time, it's very much an increase of quantitative freedoms. So just in terms of measuring time, we have more free time to do things. It's a quantitative increase. But there's a trade-off here in that that's not a qualitative sort of freedom. It's not necessarily increasing what we're able to do in our free time. And if we want to increase what we're capable of doing in our free time, you need to actually work, develop the productive forces, develop our rational understanding of the world, which means that you also have to decrease the quantitative free time. So there's a sort of tension here. If we want to increase qualitative free time or qualitative freedom, we have to decrease quantitative freedom. I think there's a sort of tension there. Which gets me to my main sort of question, which is, does it make sense to say that we should be maximizing freedom? Because does this rely upon a sort of unitary metric for freedom?
And if there's tensions between positive and negative, qualitative and quantitative, what that doesn't mean to say to maximize freedom, when precisely because we have to choose between whether we want to maximize positive or negative, qualitative or quantitative, these sorts of things. So that's my main question, I guess, for people.
I have an answer.
Good.
And it's, I've already mentioned the word, and again, I have this tendency to sort of bring back and sort of adopt and try and emphasize words that sometimes people feel a bit uncomfortable with. But the word I go for is justice. Because I think if you're interested in injustice, if you're interested in oppression, you need to be interested in freedom. If you're interested in injustice, you need to be interested in justice. Right? You need the normative criteria to understand the deviations from. Right? So what is justice? Socrates, right? What is justice? This is the archetypal Socratic question, core of normative philosophy. And I think justice is collective freedom. But again, that's not collective freedom understood abstractly. That's an attempt to, and this is why these distinctions are so important. You know, what I've said is, like, freedom is recursive. Right, you can understand through constituting a rational agent out of rational agents, but that's one way of looking at that as Hobbes's Leviathan. Right, we could all be bound in a social body that was incredibly powerful, and yet we'd all be incredibly restrained and have no individual freedom. Right, so the question of justice is the normative question of collective freedom, of how, and the way to think about this, I think, is very Spinozist, actually, in terms of how we as individuals compose parts of a whole, how we as individual monads become part of the social whole. But the way that needs to be understood normatively is in terms of balancing freedoms. So we have to expand these sort of distinctions between positive and negative thought, positive rational action, into a schematic and scale-invariant conception of the relation between individual and collective freedoms, which isn't just between the individuals in society and the society in whole, but all of the various different scales at which those individuals compose functional components, what Foucault calls practical systems, or even Marxist classes, or whatever. And what the sort of the normative principles guiding the kind of harmonious relation between freedoms should all be about how essentially you maximise individual freedom through collective freedom. The freedom at the bottom level has to be the end for which the freedom at the top level is a means. And what does this mean? It means that, in essence, what justice is about trading off individual freedoms for one another via collective freedom. Right? The state and the protocol of justice which guides the construction of the state is an attempt to negotiate and maximise our individual freedoms through collectivity.
So what's the difference between freedom and emancipation? And if you're understanding freedom in terms of justice, why not dispense with the idea of freedom altogether and theorize it in terms of justice?
I'm not understanding freedom in terms of justice. I'm understanding justice in terms of freedom.
Yeah.
Quite much. Like the whole point is start with the individual, work out what it is for an individual to be free, work out these distinctions, and then use that schema to recursively try to think about how you get collective rationality. And so the notion of collective freedom that I'm trying to articulate justice in terms of is all dependent upon doing this work first. That's why Kant is important. We start with Kant in order to get to, you know, Marx and Foucault.
I've been trying to put it back into this philosophical terms. Your example with I take a glass and I drink, yeah? It's Spinoza trying to describe it in their view of like the rational, of the spiritual, and freedom. I want to break your glass. No, I decided to take this glass and break it. Or it can be described, but these are just metal descriptions. You know, they are not ontological differences. And it can be described as like, well, I'm thirsty, he wants a drink, and then he drinks. You know, it's just a different way of describing the same thing. And if you understand it in these Spinozian terms, you don't need this freedom thing. You know, the important thing politically and so on is whether there is a kind of emancipatory gesture or it's a kind of reactionary, whether it produces like happy effect or unhappy one or negative ones. So if I understand your question correctly, it's like, do we need freedom in order to navigate or produce emancipatory actions? Right? I mean, so there's a question.
I think that's a good way of putting it, because just trying to get back to the earlier diagram. Because it basically brings us to, I said earlier that I might, in the questions, explain my disagreement with others and neo-Spinozism more fully. So, first, just to answer the one other point in the question, what do I mean by emancipation? Emancipation is increase of freedom, both quality and quality and rational action. These are the different axes of emancipation. The ideal of freedom is the ideal of engaging in a process through which we emancipate ourselves. So on these axes, I think increase that freedom along these axes. Where I get off the Spinozist train with that Deleuze and Guattari and others are on is not at the idea of like maximising freedom. Like, we both agree that, right? I think that they simply aren't quite sure what it is they're maximising. Right? Some of their ideas are great, but there are holes in them, and I think those holes are impossible to fill. And the best way to demonstrate this is to basically say that So Spinoza has this kind of mereological conception of social normativity. So that, like, so the question is, like, if my sort of normative ideal is to maximise my own personal freedom, surely that means that, like, I should do that at the expense of everybody else and the society I'm in. And Spinoza's idea is no, that's all wrong, right? You are part of a larger whole. You're part of this larger system which has its own essence and its own freedom, and that freedom should be maximised, and there's a certain sense in which your maximisation of your personal freedom needs to be subordinated to that larger whole you're part of. And there's a real insight and idea there. That's why I describe justice in kind of hardcore terms, individuals to society. The problem with it is that everything's a mode, and those modes have parts and they compose into new systems, and if you take this line you end up not being able to individuate what it is you're trying to emancipate. So the question is, like, okay, where do we stop with subordination? Do we stop at the nation we're in? Do we stop at the collective of nations we're part of? Do we stop at the humanity? Do we stop at biosphere? Do we stop at the solar system? Like, where does the subordination end? And it's not even that bad, right? Because there are horizontal problems as well. Like, should I be, like, aiming for my body's continuity? Or can I subordinate the continuity of my body to my rational project? For, like, the things I'm trying to achieve in my life. Like, my legacy, all of that. Or should I subordinate all of these to my genetic line, because I'm part of a genetic heritage, you know, my genes, they want certain maximisation to happen as well. Carl Richard Dawkins, you know. So once you take the idea seriously, you find that there's no principle of individuation for locuses of action. And what would we say? Like, what would it be to have a principle of individuation for locus of action? Like, it's rational agency, right? It's rational agents who should maximise their freedom because they have freedom. They're the things that can count as having freedom. These things can't. Right? My genetic line doesn't have freedom. There is a sense in which, as a society, we do, right? Because we can provide an account of collective self-consciousness that enables us to be collectively responsible, so on and so forth. But like that's why I get off this bit of this training. Like, it works to some extent if you have the right individuation, if you know which ones you're talking about. But in order to know which ones you're talking about, you need to kind of recognize.
But we are just, don't get me wrong, the reason why we're organizing this is because that's where we want to get, you know? But like, we are a bit turning in circles because you ended up in saying like we can, if we don't have individuation, then there is no, it's just, is it our body, is it the universe, is it, yeah, but that's exactly what like the Spinozists of today say, that we do not need to make this, it's not, the body is not the border, it's not the limit.
Okay, yeah, they so, say it, but they're wrong.
I mean, yeah, you can say they're wrong, but like, you know,
well, you don't know why you're wrong.
No, I'm just trying to get like, I'm not on the other side, you know. Yeah. I'm just observing that. I don't see a convincing argument.
Well, yeah. This is the theoretical argument. Political argument is.
No, it's a claim. It's not an argument.
No, this is the theoretical argument. It's been. I mean, have I missed something? I didn't put forward an argument over the last 2 hours, right? But the political argument as to why we need this, like the argument I've given is roughly, you know, not a complete deduction from first principles, but why I think this is true. Right? Why is thinking that this is true important? Why can't people just get on doing things? The reason is that, okay, like I was talking to Mike about this earlier. Don't know if everybody's read the introduction to Jane Bennett's Vibrant Matter. In that introduction, she gets the problem right. The problem is complexity within the social and natural world, and our inability as a society to deal with that complexity. It's an inability in the sense of an inability to constitute political will to engage with the problems that complexity confronts us with. Her solution is disastrous. Her solution is, well, maybe in order to constitute this political will, what we need is like a different effective structure. We need to kind of like sympathise with nature and with social structures in and of themselves. And maybe that'll be political will. And that the metaphor guiding that, and it is a metaphor, right? The metaphor guiding that structure is, let's think of everything as an agent. Like, everything's got agency, right? So, on the one hand, you try and think, like, complexity as agency. And in doing so, you, A, don't really understand complexity, as I think Reza sort of gives a good view of it. Yeah, like, complexity is complex, it's difficult. Just saying things act, right, is a useless way of going about it. But two, in doing that, you evacuate the concept of agency of any use. All of the conceptual tools you need to tackle the problem of political will have just been shredded, right? Like, the problem is, how do we constitute political will? Well, to do that, we have to understand what political will is. We have to understand collective agency, like the specificity of collective agency. Sorry, carry on.
I think that will address that too. I think one of the things that is interesting about what Armin is pointing out is, just to go back to the Aristotelian vocabulary, which I think elucidates something about the project of neo-rationalism as we're here to discuss, which is the emphasis on formal cause, so to speak, or on formalism itself as in a way a way of like getting rid of the determinism or this kind of like vacuousness that that you're exemplifying right now in terms of like, well, then, you know, everything becomes, you know, political agency, so to speak. Yet one of the problems is that in making extreme determinism, so to speak, or putting the necessity that determinism is able to give in the formal cause itself, you end up precisely with the form of argumentation, which is, well, why then this, where the ideals themselves become the sort of like end towards which you're trying to argue, so to speak, or end towards which you're trying to build an idea. So I think, in a way, that what is interesting about that is that then precisely the way in which commitment emerges precisely to kind of, again, like, give the emphasis, the force of the necessity that was, like, not there in the beginning, because any formalist system, in a way, or, so to speak, what we're talking about here is, like, a functionalist autonomization of reason as the space in which the arguments are given. That, I think, one of the... And Reza was saying, well, you should make that, if you didn't understand the question, well, where was the question, so to speak? There was no question, it was an observation. So I think we should try to transform that into a question, precisely, I think, to deal with this. I don't know, I'm just throwing that out there.
I would just, because what was the statement you made? You said that the program is philosophically weak, or something like that. Is that what you... I would say, to my mind, the weakness of the system has to do with its inability to really encounter an outside of itself. It's so, for example, a question was raised earlier that regarding that brought up the relationship between freedom and justice. And you said, no, I'm explaining justice in terms of freedom. But actually, I would say you're also relying on a formalist account of justice as the basis for the Kantian notions of freedom in the sense of justification. The whole project of autonomization of reason has to do with foregrounding the necessity of adequating.
Again, I just think that's a historical conclusion. Like true, right? The origin of the Kantian kind of conception of autonomy, you trace it back to Pufendorf, right? And this particular thing out of which Kant grows, and yeah, it's juridical, and that juridical line, of course, goes back to Rome, and so, of course, there's a kind of historical origin to these ideas, and it's not you shouldn't be ignorant of that origin, but similarly, you shouldn't reduce it to it, the idea that somehow I'm smuggling in justice from the beginning, I just think it's wrong, because I'm trying to actually separate out from that history the abstract functional structure. Like that's why it's important to go back to like AGI and stuff like this.
I guess I have another way of phrasing, which would be, because of course it helps to contextualize in the contemporary, I think, scenario. That's why I was emphasizing more the post-Kantian perspective,
yeah,
because of the stakes of contemporary theory, so to speak. So, because of course, the example you're giving is one precisely in which agency is just conflated with, you know, nature, or becomes a sort of like vague thing, and then where is that in that sense? So would you say then that the necessity to formulate the account that is being exposed here comes, is there a distinction between the social intellectual situation in which that account emerges and it's I guess what I'm trying to say is like, could that argument be made independently of the necessity to make a rational agency more discreet, so to speak?
I'm not quite. Well, think of it this way, right? An important thing. This is something I was on the blog. An important thing to bear in mind with rationalism, particularly kind of a political strand that I'm trying to articulate, is there's a cheap shot that people take where they think, right, oh, you're a rationalist, you think that arguments are sufficient. No,
mm-hmm.
Don't. Right? They're necessary. They're not sufficient. Right? All this formalist, functionalist work on trying to articulate the conception of freedom individually and collectively and all this stuff, building towards a philosophical account of justice, you know, that's good. So I think it's important. It's not the most important thing necessarily, but it's. I think it's helpful. I think it's. Mm-hmm. I think it's really. It's in an important sense, intellectually necessary, mm-hmm. and. But again, not sufficient, and that's why Foucault is a crucial. Like Foucault is, and Marx are crucial here, because they take you out from the individual and the social. And they actually give you through this line of thinking mm-hmm. a way of thinking about how it's complicated by social structures. But the. Just to take it back to Spinoza, the other thing is, like, okay, well, what's the con end of this necessity? What's the con end of this, the necessity for understanding what freedom is? And again, it's understanding is emancipatory. Like we, in understanding ourselves, we make ourselves more free. And in understanding what it is for us to be free, we are kind of performing an essential emancipatory gesture. So again, this isn't enough, but it's like the accusation that it isn't enough is as has been put to me by several people, is not really very good.
So I'm just curious. This is a question for both you and Nikki, and it's it has to do with criticism of the accelerated manifesto that I've heard a few times. Recently, last night, I was talking to the teaching about it. And this has to do with, I'm not sure if this rests on a correct understanding or not, but it makes it out the idea of critique of folk politics. But, and I can see already how we have a way of wiggling out of this. But if the ideal is collective self mastery, understood in terms of an increase in the in the capacity for the collective to give reasons for collective action, right? An increase in the capacity of the collective or of society to act in a way that society itself can justify. So, requiring here some sort of transparency of the social reasoning process to the members of the society, something like that. If this is the goal, then many of you understand about folk politics would just be a politics whose, for course, the reasons and means are more or less immediately transparent to the people acting in them, which sort of springs from the intelligence of the masses. Everything is kind of like associated with populism in the good sense, in the way that sort of pro-populist Marxism is always seen, emphasizing the importance of populism. The way you kind of like anti-authoritarian backlash of like emphasizing importance of populism in France, for example. The Maoist backlash. So I guess this, it seems that the critique of folk politics risks, it seems to be saying that something like we can only place our hopes on a kind of social planning that would not be causally tractable to the folk, to the masses involved. It seems to imply a certain kind of like vanguardism, a certain kind of capacity from the control and social planning from the masses and so on, and would be criticized on these grounds. That what we have here is for reasons close to what Pete seems to be saying, would not be politics at all. It would be sort of like kind of a top-down management, governmentality. That's not politics, which requires this kind of collective intelligence. So, I wonder just how you respond to that, Nick, and you as well.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. The way I sort of broadly put it is essentially the problem that, Jane Bennett set out, it's a problem of complexity. So we have massively complex systems. It's upsetting, democracy, it's upsetting our economies, it's upsetting our societies and everything. We don't quite know how to deal with it. I think what folk politics tries to do, and I'll get into this more when I present, but I think what folk politics tries to do is to reduce that complexity back down to a human size. What we want to do, accelerationist politics wants to do, is rather raise up the human, the capacities of the human, so it can deal with that complexity without getting rid of it. I think the complexity is a good thing. I think it gives us tons of advantages. And so that's really the sort of project. So
this is close to what Churchland wants to see at the sort of individual therapeutic level, but on the society too.
Yeah.
I mean, Churchland keeps folk psychology. He doesn't want to just give up on the same mind. He wants to elevate our own reflective capacities. I mean, there is that pedagogical therapeutic dimension of Churchland's program, and I think it's overlooked. Is that something you're actually analysing on the level of
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's
very,
very
different. Like civic engagement and education as well.
Yeah, so this is what I find really quite interesting about Cybersyn, you know, the Chilean experiment with, you know, sort of decentralized planning, was precisely that it allowed people to have a view of the complexity of the economy that wasn't just limited to, you know, 10 people sitting in one bureaucracy guiding the entire economy. Mm-hmm. It was instead available to everybody, and they all had a say in exactly what went on. To more or less degree, that was the ideal. But that's why it's an interesting experiment, because it does use technology in order to make the complexity amenable to us, expand our capacities to deal with complexity, rather than saying, well, we need to go into communities of, you know, Dunbar's number, 140 people or something like that. I think that's a really problematic sort of tendency of folk politics.
What I was going to say is that the word we're looking for is self-consciousness.
Yes.
It's about, like, what Nick's talking about is trying to create more advanced forms of collective self-consciousness. And again, this returns to the sort of classic platonic political problem, which is, you know, how do you get expertise? How do you get, like, social role differentiation in which expertise can be encoded within the collective process of managing the collective without thereby becoming opaque? So without having to have political myths,
right,
as opposed to the political truths that the philosopher kings engage with. And yeah, it's a question of creating effective information processing systems and instantiating the collective self-consciousness. It's also why,
Christopher, here.
We'll finish your quarter.
No, I
wouldn't
say something.
Oh, okay. You want to go first?
It was interesting that you said, like, it's about, if I understood you correctly, like, it's about the humor, right? So is it really the humor, or is it, is that the opposite between folk politics and humor? I rather think it's like folk politics and reason. So we have humor, we have reason, and Pete, you were talking about self-reflexivity, and then you were talking about collective self-consciousness. These are all very, very different categories, and we just say yes, yes, and then we have these four, and everyone agrees about, like, four very different things. So I want to ask, like, which ones of these four, or which of them are, like, can be seen parallel or identical? Reason, the human, self-reflexivity, and self-consciousness, or collective self-consciousness. So these are four or five things, and I think it would help us. There's a danger of, like, having a pseudo agreement, you know, where, you know, in truth we have a terminological chaos.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, the difference is that folk political thinking has a very sort of reduced conception of the human, which, you know, technology is not considered to be part of the human, whereas I think, you know, any sort of literature looks at technology, the history of technology, sees that humanity and technology are, you know, intertwined from the very beginning. You know, language is a technology, it's a type of technology. And so I think it's really just a matter of different conceptions of the human that are involved there. So when I, you know, you read some anarchist writing about we have to bring things down to human scale, they have a very, I think, sort of simplistic idea of what humanity is. So I think that's where the debate sort of hinges as well.
Yeah, because the reason why I'm constantly nagging around, you know, is that there is this famous Spinozian, like, we don't know what the body does, can do yet, you know. And, you know, then there is the kind of, we don't know yet what the techno-social body can do yet, which that's a very different thing. And what Razor brought into the discussion was this idea of the inhuman, you know. And so the frontiers are not so clear between these vitalist, Spinozist, rationalist.
Well, I can try and collapse them there.
So human, reason, self-reflexivity, and self-consciousness.
I collapse self-reflexivity and self-consciousness. I'm interested in just talking about consciousness and self-consciousness. And what I try to do is say that relationship, consciousness and self-consciousness, is fundamentally about rational agency. So you don't have consciousness unless you've got self-consciousness, and you don't have self-consciousness unless you've got rational agency. It's just that you can talk about both of these things at an individual and collective level. Then the question is, well, how does this relate to the human? And I think, and I, again, I agree with Reza, yeah, basically, in that the point is that, again, like, folk political understandings of the human are what I was calling earlier sort of implicit conceptions of freedom. They're just like, oh, we all know what the human is. We all know what it is to be free. We all know what it is to be someone who is worth something that we have to consider. Yeah. And it's what I'm trying to do is make all of this stuff explicit. And what that means is recognizing the sense in which our current conception of the human and the human itself is an instance of a more general structure. It's a current configuration. And the only configuration we have come across, really, of rational agency and collective rational agency. But that's to say, the human always had, like, our understanding of the human as the domain of personhood, right, is an understanding of something inhuman. And we can, as humans, decide to embrace that inhuman thing within us, individually, collectively, and push it beyond humanity, as transhumanism, or inhuman. But that is not a disavowal of humanity, because our conception of humanity was always a configuration of this thing. So this is why Reza's idea about what inhumanism comes out of humanism, not anti-humanism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's the. But the, I think the human is a particular configuration of the deeper structure, and the deeper structure is rationality and consciousness itself. Does that make sense?
It makes sense because you define it like that. But like,
that's sadly in my definition.
There's a way before between. Yeah.
I mean, in regard to this sort of dispute, it seems to me that there's something that could be brought into consideration which would bring things down to the ground a little bit, which is the question of human boundedness through bias, like heuristic traps. Cognitive biases, things that affect us from an individual level right up to a globally collective self-conscious level, the level of existential risk through self-annihilation through the various means of which not only is it possible but which are proliferating as we kind of sit here. So it seems like Pete's argument for the necessity of making things explicit, not the absolute kind of transcendental need that that be done for some kind of universal moral reason, but rather for maximizing our potential. It would also be for maximizing our available perspective to potentially see the ways that whenever we leave things implicit, we don't only leave them up to someone else to define on a social level, but also just to ourselves to get them wrong. Whatever the body can do is not always a good thing. My body can get things incredibly wrong and will continue to do that for as long as I'm alive. So, I mean, just in terms of I'm going to take a stance which is, you know, outside of some kind of universal necessity, I will want to make it explicit simply that so I don't shoot myself in the foot, you know, literally or figuratively at some point.
Yeah, you're completely right. It's that consciousness exists at the level of heuristics. Self-consciousness is unpacking heuristics and correcting them and revising them. Completely.
Nick was talking about politics beyond the binary distinction between technology and human time, but if I'm understanding your argument correctly, and I may well not be, you're drawing a clear categorical boundary around consciousness as the deciding factor, and you seem to be drawing that on a human scale, which is convenient for us, but well, and you kind of talked about that a little bit just now. But if consciousness is the deciding factor, then does your framework, can your framework address cases or scales where the distinction between consciousness and not is not clear, or where is it entangled?
The thing I've got to say is, like, I always use the word consciousness with a pinch of salt because it is one of the most poorly defined terms in the philosophical vocabulary. I bring it in as something I defined within the context of a kind of Kantian approach. That's why I say, like, there is no consciousness unless there is self-consciousness, and self-consciousness is defined in terms of rational faculty. It's not consciousness understood as some people tend to, which is whatever this is here. Like, some people will say, like, oh, there's this big problem, the hard problem of consciousness, how do we get from brains to this? And if your idea of consciousness is kind of indexical like that, it's completely worthless. There's no explanatory. There are more interesting conceptions of consciousness in various different aspects of the literature, like global workspace views and sort of functional conceptions of the brain and this, that, and the other. I'm just kind of cutting across all that. So if the question is, well, can you deal with the consciousness of tapeworms, then my answer is, tapeworms are not consciousness, right, in this sense, very specifically defined, right? But again, the other side of this is, from my perspective, collective individuals and people can have collective consciousness, even though they have nothing that resembles what we might think of as a quality of experience. There's no, like, sensorum for a collective. But they don't have anything resembling sort of cognitive collective workspace that is instituted in the brain. But they have the possibility of developing self-consciousness, and therefore they're conscious. Right? You have information processing systems which have a certain functional structure sufficient to call it conscious. I get, when I talk about consciousness and self-consciousness, I just want to get completely away from the idea that consciousness has anything to do with having sensory mechanisms that are within, like, ours. It's not indexed to those at all. It's,
just to kind of, I guess, to kind of continue that point in a sense about consciousness. See, when you pull together this dialectic, it's like this is very much kind of like the mainstream Western philosophical canon that you get taught in, if you do a philosophy bachelor's, I imagine. But there are certain things which seem to me to be kind of obviously telling, but which are not present there at all, like one of those being the whole Freudian tradition, for instance. It's just kind of a hole in that. And there is, I think it bears interestingly on the relation of a certain kind of like above borderness, the whole Kantian tradition, the idea of making it explicit and this kind of thing. They're sort of saying, like, oh, we will take these things which we don't understand at the moment, but then we will understand them and so on. And it's completely different if you look at psychodynamic stuff like Nicholas Abraham and Maria Torok's Understanding of Language, for instance, is basically a continual evasion of really unpleasant facts and this kind of thing. But anyway, my point was that a lot of this conversation about reason seems to me to really fundamentally require a very general universal kind of point of view. We talk about the collective subconsciousness and this kind of stuff. But at the same time, as I've said to you before, actually, when you actually look at Brandon or Anton Egan or something, people like that, they'll talk about consciousness being, reasoning being a collective process and that kind of thing, but their examples are almost always interpersonal. They're always like two or three people. And isn't there, like, really a massive shortfall in that sort of progression from the local towards the global, which is actually the subject of people like Hayek and someone, you know, and they say, well, actually, it's quite explicitly, it's just like a tradition of my marriage or something like that. It might make sense to literally no one on an individual level. Yet, it persists and survives because of the level of, like, social structuring and that kind of thing. Like, it actually plays functions which are completely non-obvious from a local point of view. And, I kind of wonder how that fits into the schema. I can see that, you become aware of these things, you can root them back in.
Obviously this is a selection, a very particular selection of the whole history of,
I'm not saying you have to talk about all of it.
I've talked about a lot of it.
Yeah. my street art.
Yeah.
You know, street art is a hunting of birds. It's not in there, so.
But no, I mean, there's definite points of intersection that need to be, particularly with Hayek, actually. Because one way of looking at Hayek, I was talking to Nick and Alex about this, is that Hayek is an account of like collective consciousness in which collective self-consciousness is verboten.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, you can't have self-consciousness. If we get self-consciousness, it'll be ruined. You'll ruin it.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's I think Hayek's wrong, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't engage with this account of consciousness. We need an account of heuristics and information processing. Well, there's stuff to be done here. I think we should probably stop there, though.
Can I just, on this point, the issue of collective self-consciousness being totally different from, being completely different from human self-consciousness seems to me not to be the issue so much, from my perspective, as it being dependent on the parasitic on human exclusion. That's an issue. That's an issue from a perspective of like a focus on power rather than on reason, which is kind of just the flip side of the same question as you pointed out.
I think power is part of the schema. I think, like, what's interesting is power is the, in many ways, the universe of reason, right? And so if you want to understand power, try and understand it by a, like, understand it as a mythology, right? If you want to understand it as a mythology, understand the functions it's a mythology of.
Super quick remark. But just to, and then the question is precisely because you yourself said the rational, you know, it's not like arguments themselves are sufficient, but you know, the juridical has to be complemented with the medical, so to speak, and that's the virtue of Spinoza's, right? But that is, I think, here where we need to find ways of developing positively, because it is weighing a bit heavily on the side of the juridical, so to speak. And we are, I think, in a way, kind of realizing, yeah, obviously we don't. There are problems with the ones that try to overextend the medical, so to speak, and make that itself a sort of, you know, plateau to start. And you know, there are plenty of examples of that. So I think just framing that challenge explicitly,
just see this as a conceptual framework, right?
Yeah.
It's not sufficient. This is not the complete story. I'm never going to give the complete story because all of the work that we've been doing is actually a collective of epistemological endeavour. But this is an attempt to kind of navigate through the conceptual space in such a way that we can link up the information stuff. So that we can link up the kind of Hayekian ideas about information systems and economies, and we can link up these ideas about collective health. And so we can link these things together. I just think that the rationalist functionalism is the connecting point. It gives you a kind of conceptual skeleton to integrate these things together on. But yeah, I'll stop there.